This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Does A stand for average? A survey conducted by Princeton University last year showed that nearly half of all grades given out at America's elite colleges, the Ivy League schools, plus Stanford, MIT, and the University of Chicago, were A's. In a recent study of incoming college freshmen, almost half reported an A average in high school. So what's the distinction between outstanding and good? Many education experts believe that high grade point averages are a product of compromised standards and that students simply aren't being challenged to produce their best work. Others argue that all of those A's reflect widespread excellence, better students, and better teachers. If you're a student, a teacher, or a parent, we want to hear from you. Are standards slipping? Are teachers being pressured to give out good grades? Is grade inflation really an issue today? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or you can email us, TOTN at NPR.org. And we begin at Princeton. Last week, the university faculty voted 2-1 to limit the number of A's they award. Next semester, no more than 35% of the grades at Princeton are expected to be A's. That's down from 46% right now. Beth Bogan is an economics professor at Princeton, and she joins us now by phone from her home in New Jersey. And Professor Bogan, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
I understand you voted in favor of the proposal. Why do you think grade inflation has become a problem?
Yes, I did vote in favor of the proposal, and I do think it's become a problem across the nation, in part because faculty feel pressured to give higher grades, especially junior faculty that are looking for promotions, and I don't think that that's a good thing for the students. Can I give you some of the reasons why I voted for it?
Yes, you can. And I just wanted to ask, why do the number of A's reflect, you know, particularly junior professors' employment?
Oh, well, when one goes up for tenure, there are many things involved. Of course, research at Princeton is the most important, but also student evaluations matter. And I think young professors are particularly concerned that they might get bad evaluations from the students if they didn't give a lot of A's.
Okay, now tell us the reasons why you voted in favor.
There are actually several important reasons. One is better information to students on what is really outstanding academic work. Part of this whole faculty effort has been to discuss what every grade means. Secondly, it should encourage students to stretch and grow intellectually, and it should better inform students about their relative abilities. I find students need answers to questions like, among the disciplines I like, what do I do best? There was more grade inflation in some departments than in others, so uneven grading standards were distorting the selection of majors. For example, if a student got an A in economics and a B-plus in English, that should be an indication that she's better at economics. But if econ gave almost all A's and English very few, the student might not realize her true skills. And also, in order to fight grade inflation for these reasons, we needed a collective agreement. You know, there's little incentive for an individual faculty member to fight inflation, and also one person just doesn't have much effect even if they tried. And finally, we actually think that making the grades more serious will help Princeton students competing for fellowships in graduate school admission, because people will know that no more than 35% on average across the university got A's.
Now, some professors, I understand, argue that this decision impinges on their academic freedom.
Yes, some faculty were afraid of being told how to grade, but the problem is you can't do it individually. And so it's important to realize that the faculty agreed to this. It was not the administration telling the faculty what to do. And so I think most faculty will be bound by the democratic decision that we should do it together collectively.
Some might say that 35% people getting A's, that's still an awful lot of A's.
Yes, I would agree that it's somewhat arbitrary where we drew the line. But also, in terms of making shades of distinction, we give A pluses, A's, and A minuses. So it's 35% restricted to those three grades, actually.
But A, B, C, and D, you'd think 20% would be in the A category.
One might, but that simply isn't where things have gone. And I think it would make too dramatic a change. Very large changes are more disruptive than middle-sized changes, in my opinion.
How will this decision change the way you think about grading?
Well, I will be more careful to be consistent. I'll be more careful to make sure that A work is really outstanding performance in my classes.
Can you take a call with us?
Sure.
Our number, by the way, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255. Email is totn@npr.org. And Karen is on the line with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I was first in college at Syracuse University in the mid-1970s, and I was getting more C's than A's. And I probably deserved more C's than A's. Now, a year and a half ago, I went back to school at the University of Phoenix, and I recently got my first B, and up until then it had been all A's. And I was upset, not with the professor, but with myself, because I'm working twice as hard as I was when I was getting C's. So I'm thinking, yes, maybe some grade inflation, but if you actually do the work and you do it well and you work hard and you're getting the answers right, you still deserve the A's regardless of how many people in the class meet that standard.
Professor Bogan?
Well, if the standards are high, it's hard for everybody in the class to meet the standards. I think in your case, Karen, it probably was quite true that you were more motivated, more mature when you went back, and you probably are an outstanding student. But I don't think everybody in the classroom can be outstanding by definition.
Mm-hmm. So, well, but not everybody's getting all A's either.
Well, we're just trying to make sure that that's not the case. We're seeing some places where some departments 60-70% A's, and I think that really distorts the information that's coming out.
What about just another thing I'm gleaning from Karen's call, and that is that maybe back in the 70s, people might have been blinded by disco balls or something, but there did seem to be more C's and B's given out then than there are now. What's changed?
You're asking me what's changed, or Karen, what's changed?
I'm asking you what's changed.
Okay. Well, in part, there are better students going to university. People are better trained. But I don't think that has as much to do with it as just the general grade inflation that has occurred. Used to be that, okay, a C was passing. You worked hard. That showed you knew most of the material. Then pretty soon we came to think that that meant somebody was nearly flunking. And so we've let it drift.
But on the other hand, if you have a situation like with adult learners at University of Phoenix, I don't want to carp on that particular university, but people who have gone back to school, they're going to be more motivated than 18 to 20-year-olds who are, you know, also away from home for the first time and maybe academics are not their highest priority.
I'd have to agree with that. There may be reasons why some schools should have more than 35% A's. I wasn't meaning to say that it was exactly the same for everybody, but I think that within Princeton it's been important to make this change.
Mm-hmm. Karen, good luck.
Thank you.
What are you studying, by the way?
Accounting.
Accounting.
Well, accounting, yeah.
Hang in there.
I'm a CPA.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And Professor Bogan, we appreciate your time today as well.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Beth Bogan is a professor of economics at Princeton University. She was with us by phone from her home in New Jersey. Well, it takes two to make a grade. Joining us now to give a student perspective on the Princeton's decision to cut back on the number of A's is Evan Baer, a junior at Princeton University. He joins us by phone from a campus building. And thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks a lot, Neil.
So how are students reacting to the decision to cut back on the number of A's?
Well, Neil, it's unquestionably been one of the most hotly debated and discussed academic concerns during my time here at Princeton. And in general, I think students are very sympathetic with problems and understanding the implications of grade inflation. The implication of imposing or creating a new policy today, however, is that it fairly unfairly burdens the graduating students in the next few years.
So all of a sudden, your grade point average is going to go down. You'll look bad by comparison.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
I'd like to address just briefly the point that Professor Bogan brought up, that some faculty are arguing that, well, in graduate school or job or fellowship applications, the people reviewing these will know that an A at Princeton is harder to get, or they are limited there. And while over time that might sort of become part of the lingo or the understanding of people reading these applications, it's unrealistic to think that they will know this and be aware of it for the next few graduating classes.
In other words, the transitional people will get it in the neck.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now, is she right also that, you know, every school, I'm sure, has that guy grades soft, that woman over there really tough. Is that the case at Princeton?
In terms of certain professors is more difficult than others.
And certain parts of the, you know, maybe economics is easy and English is hard?
Oh, unquestionably. People think that not only different levels of courses, but across the department, certain departments give more A's. And I think this gets back to what does an A really mean? An A at Princeton might mean something different than an A from a community college, just like an A in Princeton economics department might be different from the Princeton engineering department. So with an A, you also have to examine the type of course, the department, and the sort of caliber of institution that's issued such the grade.
Well, would you agree, and do students agree, that if 46% of the grades handed out at Princeton are A's, maybe there's been a little inflation?
I unquestionably, it's hard to deny the reality of just looking at the numbers over the past years of grades slowly creeping up, and that they've slowly crept up over this time. One could turn around and say, well, maybe the ideal response is gradually decreasing these grades over the next several years instead of a more drastic 11% cutoff to be imposed over 1 year. Just to throw out a few numbers, if you think about Princeton undergraduate student body of 4,500 students taking 8 classes a year with about 2 papers in each class, this policy means that 8,000 papers in the next academic year will get B's instead of A's. When you think about it, it's a lot of people getting lower grades.
Let's get another caller on the line. Gene is with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Well, my comment is, first of all, what are you trying to accomplish by your grading system? If an A is to show that the professor has taught well and the student has learned the material, what are you trying to accomplish?
So, in other words, what are the distinctions between A, B, and C?
That's right. I feel like if an entire class is making C's or below, then a professor is not doing a very good job.
And it might reflect in their possibilities for tenure as well.
For example, my wife in the 70s at the university was always in the top three of her classes, making 97 and 98s on tests, but professors forced a bell curve, and that 97 or 98 percentile threw her to a B.
Mm-hmm. Well, Evan Baer, to go back to the example of Princeton, what do you think those three things mean, A, B, and C? Gene, I was talking to our student. Excuse me.
I think that in general, the grades reflect student performance being consistent with department-wide criteria. Various departments come up with standards for what an A or a B or a C means, and actually these criteria are sent out to students, so we're very aware of sort of the levels of performance that we have to meet in order to get certain grades. Now, under the existing system, we are competing against those criteria. We write our papers to be consistent with it, and we master certain subject areas so we can perform in the exams. Under the new policy, we're not competing against these criteria, but rather we're competing solely against other students.
Well, Evan Baer, we wish you good luck, and obviously the people, when the changes are made, may suffer by comparison a little bit, but maybe all the publicity will make everybody aware that an A at Princeton next year is going to be pretty tough.
Well, I hope so, too. Thanks a lot, Neil.
Evan Baer is a junior at Princeton, and he joined us by phone from the campus there in New Jersey. We're talking about the impact of grade inflation, and we'll take more of your calls after a break and find out how widespread grade inflation is around the country. 800-989-8255. Email us, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing grade inflation, particularly at universities. Is it just too easy to get an A today? If you're a student or a teacher, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, or email us, TOTN at NPR.org. Joining us now is Stuart Roystechair. He's professor of environmental science at Duke University, who's collected nationwide data on grade inflation at over 80 schools, and he's with us now from the studio at Stanford University. Good of you to join us on Talk of the Nation.
Hello, Neil.
Is grade inflation a reality? How hard is it to get an A these days?
It's easier to get an A than it was 20 years ago. My data shows that it's a pervasive problem across the country.
This just at obviously you're talking about 80 schools that you've studied, so more than just the elite universities.
Right. It's across the grain of community colleges, state schools, flagship state schools, elite universities, and just plain good private schools. Grade inflation is everywhere. I did a survey of about 84 schools representing about 1 million undergraduate students. And at those 84 schools, 80 of them had considerable grade inflation over the last 20 years.
When, according to your survey, did it start?
Well, if you look at the time trends in grading across the country, what you find is that grade inflation initially started in the Vietnam era. And it was widely accepted at that time that grades were rising because professors were being kind to students who were trying to avoid the draft. And then it stabilized. GPA stabilized in the mid-1970s to the mid-1980s. They were relatively flat across the country. And then sometime in the mid-1980s, they took off again, and they've been rising ever since for the last two decades.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. Mark joins us on the line from San Francisco.
Hi.
Hi.
A couple of points. First, I read years ago William F. Buckley in an essay proposed that baccalaureate degrees be assigned the equivalent to what one might call a vintage date, if you will, to help accommodate the grade inflation and just the capriciousness that enters academia from one year, one era to the next. Where it would be almost like an index that you graduated from, say, Princeton in 1947 with this particular grade point average, and you would accumulate a score for that.
Well, Professor Roystechair, maybe you could work out a formula by which to equalize all of these grade point averages.
Actually, I've already done that inadvertently. There's a chart on my website, gradeinflation.com, which shows trends in GPA over time, and I'm told that prospective employees are using that chart to sort of re-equilibrate their grade point averages to what they might be today.
Well, Mark, I'm sure your grade point average was a grand cru.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. I wanted to read this email that we got from David. Grades, a form of ranking, he writes, are not especially useful in educating students. What is useful is criticism and evaluation. That's where standards are really put out there to challenge students and do better to reach for excellence. So what's the point of these grades?
Are you asking me what the point of grading is?
I guess it is, yeah.
There's no one-size-fits-all reason for grading, but there seems to be a need for it. Employers want to know what the grade point average is of a student. Graduate schools and professional schools want to know what that grade point average is. And some students, I would estimate in the classes that I teach, about 20 to 30% of them need the motivation of grades to do well.
So this is, I guess, just the argument over SAT scores writ large.
Exactly right. Mm-hmm.
Another caller now. Neil is with us from Winona, Minnesota.
That's right. Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Appreciate it. When I was a freshman in the university back in 69, I had a accounting professor who ended up giving about 60% A's and was called on the carpet because of it. He gave us all a nationwide accounting test, independent of his, and we all scored that high to validated the grade he gave us. My point being that sometimes you get a batch of students that are that good compared to everyone else. What then?
Professor Roystechair?
I think there needs to be flexibility in any sort of grading policy on the part of a university. So if you have a class, and I've had classes where people are just doing an excellent job, not across the board, but a significant percentage, and the grade point average for that class reflects that. So that flexibility is in place in the Princeton system, this new Princeton system, where the 35% is not for every class, but for the department as a whole, a recommended standard for that year.
Well, how can you detect when grade inflation is happening? Is this something you have to judge over time?
Yeah, you have to have many years of data. It's really, it's a creeping, insidious thing. The rate of grade inflation is small on a year-to-year basis, but over time, it starts to creep up and be significant.
Hmm.
As an example, if you look at the current rate of grade inflation across the country, the rise in GPA is 0.15 per decade. That's what the rate is. And what that corresponds to is, suppose, Neil, you were teaching a class of 100 students, and every year you were to take one to two of those students, and instead of giving a B, give them an A.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the rate of grade inflation we're seeing. So every year, that's a small amount. But over a decade, that's 15 students that you used to be giving a B, you're now giving an A to. And over 20 years, it's 30 students. So it's a creeping process.
Neil, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's talk now with Laura. And Laura is with us from Hampton, Virginia.
Yes. My question is more at the high school level, perhaps, than the college or university level, and that is, does politics play a role in grade inflation? And if so, to what degree?
Politics, I mean, in what sense?
Politics within the university and outside forces.
Okay.
I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, Laura, thanks very much. Professor Roystechair?
I don't really understand what that question is about in terms of politics. At the high school level, certainly there are policies like the Hope Scholarship in Georgia where students have to maintain a certain GPA in order to be eligible for funding. And that's a political rule that certainly has influenced grading policies in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
But aside from that, I don't think politics really plays a role.
Well, what about, policies like No Child Left Behind, where the school would really have be better itself if all of its students got A's?
Oh, certainly there's social promotion that takes place across the country. Does that take place in college where people are passing classes that maybe they shouldn't pass? That certainly happens.
Email question from Patty. Is it actually easier to get an A now, or do simply more people accomplish the feat? Did you guess actually assess the relative levels of accomplishment achieved by all these students? Maybe more people are achieving complete mastery of college subjects.
It would be difficult to ascribe the rising GPAs to better students. There would have to be some sort of other indicator, and there really is no indicator that students have been getting better across the country. SAT scores have not been rising. If anything, the amount of work required in individual classes in terms of workload has dropped. Maybe that's also a factor in rising GPAs. But the idea that students across the country are getting better and that's why GPAs are rising is, to me, a canard.
One way to deal with the dilemma of grading is to forego the alphabet completely. Joining us now to talk about alternative grading methods is Merle Bruno, a biology professor at Hampshire College in Massachusetts. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Hampshire College doesn't give letter grades, actually. Can you explain how students are evaluated?
Students are evaluated through narrative evaluations. Faculty write at different points in the semester, and then at the end of the semester, that's what goes into their permanent file.
And how do students react?
Well, when they first get here, of course, they know that there is such a thing, but I think their first experience after 12 years of receiving grades is that it's sometimes a little unnerving. They want to know how they're doing. And even though the evaluations tell them very specifically how they're doing, it sometimes takes a few months before they start realizing that they know a lot more. A student was just telling me yesterday, because I knew this program was coming up, that she was nervous about it till she went home for vacation, and all her friends were saying what their letter grade averages were, and she said, well, what does that mean? how are you doing at this, that, or the other thing? And she had a very specific idea of how she was doing.
I wonder, how do parents react? Do they read these evaluations, by the way?
Students can allow parents to see copies of the evaluations. They can either send them themselves or say they have access to them. And they find them extremely informative. When it says that, you know, this student has very good analytical writing but really needs to pay attention to organizational skills or needs a little more work on quantitative skills, then they know what they might be encouraging their child to work more on.
Tuition at Hampshire is comparable to many of the elite universities. I think it's, over $38,000 a year with room and board. Do students at Hampshire become more aggressive along the way in trying to demand a kinder evaluation since they're paying an awful lot there?
It's funny you'd think that, but actually I think the opposite occurs. They become a little more aggressive than what they expected themselves in order to receive evaluations. When there's not a top level of standard, you know what you need to do to get an A, they just keep pushing. So if you do get the kind of classroom where you have all excellent students and you would want to give them all A's, even when you give a group of students all A's, you know they're not all excellent in the exact same ways. This way you can push each of them in the ways that you think each of them should be moving.
Now, are students there failed?
If they don't complete the work for the course, then they don't have that course counted, and they won't have enough courses to graduate. We don't count courses to graduate. A committee of faculty that works with each student reviews all these evaluations and their work and decides when that work satisfies the contract that the student has made with the faculty.
I may be stuck in old thinking, so you might get an incomplete but not an F.
Sure.
Okay. Now, I wonder how do prospective employers, graduate schools, respond to these kinds of evaluations?
Very well. Not at first, of course. Our registrar works very closely with graduate schools, professional schools, and employers to introduce them to what the transcript will look like. And we've also worked very hard to refine the transcript so that we don't send an inch-thick book. But when they finally look at it, they say, I know what I'm going to be getting. I see the quality of work, the kinds of strengths the student has, and where they might, where I might put them to do the best job.
Now, another point, Hampshire College, a relatively small institution. Could you see something like this working at, say, Ohio State University?
It would certainly be harder, but I think there are ways to play with the system so that you don't have... I found, because I've taught in large systems, and one of the most agonizing things for me was to have a student that I knew could do brilliant work and did do brilliant work and then sloughed off in a few places, and then I'd have to give a C. And a C for one student may be one thing, and a C for another student, another. Whereas if I could tell them what the distribution of work was within that C, it would be much more informative.
Merle Bruno, thanks very much.
Okay.
Professor Bruno at Hampshire College in Massachusetts. She teaches biology there, and she joined us from up there. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And still with us is Stuart Royster, Chair, Professor of Environmental Science at Duke University, who's done a nationwide survey of grade inflation. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Max, who's joining us from Petaluma, California.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I just wanted to offer the perspective of somebody who went to a top-ranked college and got straight A's at Pomona College, but also studied abroad in Europe, where the system was based out of 20, and a good grade was a 12. I think I got a 7 as an average, and that was the best of any American, and I was kind of happy for it.
So these were very tough grading standards,
It was very tough, and it was understood, though, that it was very opposite than the American system of education in general. They don't hold your hand over there in any way, and if you really messed up in a class, the professor could possibly give you a negative grade out of 20.
Ooh! did this motivate you to work harder, do you think?
It did, but it was also, I was glad that I declared some of those classes pass no credit because it was hard to translate back to an American system. where they still didn't understand the relative grade. So I will have sympathy with some of those transitional classes that the student from Princeton was talking about.
Professor Royster-Chair, it's hard to imagine that sort of system being introduced in this country.
I don't think it will be implemented anytime soon. I mean, what you're looking at Princeton is essentially dropping the mean GPA down from about 3.4 to 3.25. And what the caller is talking about is something that I experienced firsthand supervising Duke students in Italy, where I had to renegotiate grades that Italian professors were giving my students to make them look reasonable in American eyes.
So the gentlemanly seven, perhaps. Max,
exactly.
Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you, Anil.
See if we get one more caller in before we have to go. Tom is with us from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Hello. I'm an MIT graduate, and I just wanted to make a comment that I read a study about MIT graduates, and there was absolutely no correlation between future income and grade point average, 10 or 20 years after graduation. So at least among MIT graduates, it really didn't matter what grades you made as long as you graduated, I guess.
Any information about that, Professor Royster-Chair?
I have no data on income of graduating students relative to their GPA, and I would caution anyone to use income as a sign of personal happiness.
Okay. Tom, did the grade point average, though, help people get into graduate school?
Oh, yes, that was important. But I'm a medical doctor, and it helped me get into medical school. However, this study, actually, interestingly, there was a small rise in income among C students and a small rise among A students, but it was not statistically significant.
So the worst off were the Bs?
The Bs and Ds were lower than the Cs and As, interestingly. I don't know why that is, but anyway.
Anyway, maybe it's just MIT students. You never know with them.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Appreciate the phone call, Tom.
Okay, thank you.
And Stuart Royster-Chair, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Neil.
Stuart Royster-Chair is a professor of environmental science at Duke University, and he joined us today from the studio at Stanford University. Well, when we come back from a short break, get ready for your close-up. You, or at least your house, could be on the cover of Reason magazine. If you'd like to talk to us about database information, join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Are you pleased with all of the information that could be tailored just for you when you log on to the web or get marketing surveys, or are you alarmed at the possibility that your privacy might be impinged upon? 800-989-TALK. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.